ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
The Science Show this week begins a series featuring some of the most extraordinary people you can imagine, including later some women who changed the course of history. Today it's a man who invented a whole universe, a disc world held up by an elephant and plenty of turtles. Fantasy, yes, but Terry Pratchett's world was and is a romp through massive scientific ideas. So bold that the Vice-Chancellor from the University of South Australia became besotted by them, with splendid consequences. So let's leap to earlier this year at the Hawke Centre in Adelaide and an introduction by the retiring Chancellor of the University, the Honourable John Hill.
Sir Terry Pratchett was awarded an honorary doctorate from the University of South Australia in 2014, and his legacy continues to support UniSA master's students through the Sir Terry Pratchett Memorial Scholarship. This event continues and celebrates the special connection between Pratchett and the university, and I'm pleased to see so many here tonight. I found out an interesting fact about Robin Williams just in brief conversation. Then Robin was telling me he appeared in very early episodes of Doctor Who. Now, that's something you may not know. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome David Lloyd and Robin Williams for what promises to be a compelling evening.
Dr. Williams.
But I was in far more Monty Python's than Dufferin's. Chancellor, I thought you might be interested in an interpretation of your role from Terry Pratchett and Discworld, where you're represented by Arch-Chancellor Rumustrum Ridicoli, who's highly intelligent, incredibly stubborn, and never to be underestimated. He's the chief wizard and head of Unseen University in Moving Picket Pictures. That's from 1990. So that's a good description of your good self.
Yeah. Sorry, Tom.
Right, I see. I'm going to start by asking you two impossible questions. First, what was Terry Pratchett's favourite number? And second, what was his favourite colour?
And the reason I know this is because in 2008, when Terry first came to Dublin for his, I think it was his sixth honorary doctorate at the time. He stopped counting at the time, but it was the first one he got from a university that was older than he was. And when he came to Dublin, my daughter, Amelia, she was only five. And I was going to do an interview, a public interview with Terry. We were in rows, so we had dribbly candles. It was quite unseen university at the time. And I said to him, I'm going to meet the man who is in all the books that we have on the bookshelf. I said, we can ask him any question we want. And you know, she said, there were two questions that she wanted me to ask Terry Pratchett. What's your favorite color? What's your favorite number? And I didn't ask him live. I asked him the next day. He was going back to the UK. I said, Terry, I've got two questions from my daughter. And he goes, oh, yeah. And I said, what is your favorite color? And he went, oh, I've never been asked a question like that before. He says, he closed his eyes and he went, very, very pale bluey green. Right? It was the color of the lime rendered plaster in his office in the chapel. He'd had this restoration done and that was the color that the lime render had come out. I said, and what is your favorite number? And he said, this your daughter? I said, yeah. And he said, what age is she? And I said, she's five. He said, tell her it's six.
Yes. You can tell from that how the man's mind worked. Associations, ones that tell you more both about him and the subject. Most of us would just, off the top of our heads, mention something that doesn't matter and it would disappear. But people who write good stuff, associations like that, Now, I asked a few people, my colleagues, about Terry Pratchett, and I expected them to say, huh? Or vaguely heard about it or something like that. In fact, all young smart people, obviously in the ABC, I'm surrounded by young smart people. One dear colleague, Sarah Dingle, who's on Current Affairs, I said, could you send me two lines as to why you think Terry Pratchett is terrific? And she wrote this. Terry Pratchett's books, to me, are a masterclass in fantastical comedic scholarship. Somehow, he manages to have sufficient encyclopedic knowledge of political, social, and industrial history across the Western world in order successfully to make fun of it all. Also, he has great characters. Would you agree with that analysis of hers?
Yeah. Terry was like an omnivore when it came to information. He just read everything. And he credited his education with the Beaconsfield Library, which is where he grew up. But he read everything. And he said to me once, I have a pack rat mind. I just take it all and I put it into my nest. And then whenever I need it, I take it back out again. And the characters, the early books were very much kind of pastiches of Lord of the Rings and sword and sorcery, fantasy kind of novels. But as the series evolved, the characters became deeper and deeper. And the fact that Night Watch is the sixth book in a series that goes on for much longer afterwards, and probably would have continued far afterwards if Terry hadn't passed away. Across 41 books, he invented these amazing people, but he populated them with interesting tidbits. And even when he wasn't in Discworld, even when he stepped off Discworld, he had this ability to surface amazing characters. We were once having lunch in a restaurant. Terry had posterior cortical atrophy, which meant that his dementia got him from the back of his mind to the front of his mind. So it happened quite slowly and insidiously over time. But one of the things that went was his visual acuity and his ability to discern depth. So it was very hard for him to actually figure out where things were and where surfaces ended. And we went for lunch at this place and it had Penrose paving. It looks very three-dimensional. And he walked in and he went, this is the worst place in the world to bring someone with Alzheimer's. But we navigated the floor eventually. And we got to the table, we were having lunch. And in the middle of this stew, he goes, do you know what a tosheroon is?
A tosheroon?
Yeah. And I went, no. And he goes, oh, you're supposed to be one of those clever chaps. You're supposed to be from the university. You're supposed to know all these things. I said, well, I don't know what a tosheroon is. He goes, it is a small fatberg from a sewer. Right? Except in tosheroon were these things that the urchins in Victorian England used to go into the sewers to find, because oftentimes where they'd find rings that had dropped down the sewer or money, a tosheroon was a fatberg in miniature, which would contain a rich centre in treasure. And he'd found that and he wanted to share it. And he uses the word once in 43 books, but it was one of those things that he wanted to convey.
Extraordinary, isn't it? May I say that your own short book, which I helped you encourage to write, has got some of those stories. And it's beautifully written by you.
Thank you.
It's gorgeous stuff. One thing I must ask you, talking about formal dress that you were in during that ceremony, you've got a particular description of the flat PhD or honorary doctorate hat that you have to wear.
Yeah, I do. And I used to have a bright blue one, which I hated.
And share it.
It is a velvet cowpat. Yeah. There's no fashionable way to wear a doctor.
You put a cowpat on your head and you're a doctor.
You put corks on it and you've got an honorary doctor from the University of South Australia.
How come someone who's a professor of chemistry was so enamoured of a writer like Terry Pratchett?
The first Pratchett book I picked up was in 1988, and I was 14, and it was a mate of mine. He said, you have to read this. This is so funny. And I read lots of books, but it was Sorcery, which is like book five in the series. It's not even the first book in this world. And by the third page, it was always the funniest thing I'd ever read. And I just thought it was witty, it was imaginative, it was captivating. The covers were like this massively colourful thing. And I was hooked, absolutely hooked. And then I discovered that there were four more before that, and then there was lots more after it. So you could read into them. And it became this annual event. When a new Pratchett book would come out, you'd wait to get it. And I remember then graduating from the Corgi paperbacks, which is what I could afford to buy when I was like in my teens, to when I actually had a paycheck, I could buy the hardcover. And the first hardcover Pratchett book that I bought was Night Watch.
Wow.
And it was also the first book I got Terry to sign.
when he saw Indra, he said, "I've devalued it now." Night Watch was written after a bit of a lull in his writing. He slowed down to only about 10 books a year. No, it was a bit of a break. Why did he start again and why was it so successful?
There's a few theories. So Rob Wilkins was Terry's literary manager and he's the state manager now. And we've known each other since 2008 when Terry got us on dock. But Rob's view is that, like, Terry's been dead now for 10 years. And in those 10 years, he's sold 20 million copies posthumously. So he sells 2 million copies a year, even without trying, right? And that's with no new material. So he sold about 100 million copies of the Discworld novels since the first one came out. And by the time of Night Watch, Terry was in the Big Read top 100. He actually had, I think he had 3 books as a living author in the BBC's top 100. And he was the best-selling English language author in the world. Like, he was the UK's number one. And then Harry Potter arrived. And J.K. Rowling had created, well, whereas Terry had always been in this interesting space where he was writing comic fantasy, but they were largely allegory and they weren't meant to be taken as swords and sorcery. This was this fantastical, magical universe of Hogwarts and what have you. And she knocked Terry so far off his perch from a bestseller perspective, he wasn't the top UK author anymore. And at that time, when Night Watch was written, on one level, he had the creative space to just write what he wanted to write, not to actually satisfy to have to be the top one again. He was just writing the book he wanted to write. But the other one was, he says he wrote it with a fury and an anger, and the pages were just piled up because he was released from this burden of bestseller. And he wrote a lot of books simultaneously. That was usually, he'd have 2 or 3 books on the go. Night Watch was one where he just flowed out of them.
Now, you're one of the best-selling living authors in our language. How many books have you sold?
We think about 30 million. It's quite hard to measure them anymore because once you get to, like, Eastern Europe and places like that, it's just hard to keep track. But my agent reckons about 30 million.
How many do you write a year?
2. Most years, 2 books.
Now, I've read that when you finish one book, you just start on the next one straight away. Have you got one boiling away now?
I have finished the next book and I'm working on the one after that. But, I mean, lest people run away with the wrong idea, it's a kind of superstition. I don't like being left with no book to write. You know, I finished a book, and on the same day, I'll open up some file with some notes and a title. It really isn't a case of I finish typing the last word of the novel and then go to another page and start typing the first word of the next novel. It's more of a superstitious thing, so that I always have a book I'm working on.
You mentioned Harry Potter just now. Now, I've got a theory. Fantasy, a lot of it I don't go for instance, the TV series, Game of Thrones, the minute they start killing people and indeed throwing a child off the cliff, the young dog off the battlement of a castle, I've had that. It's enough of that on the news that you can't, turn off quickly enough. And so, as far as I'm concerned, the interesting thing about Pratchett and also Harry Potter, there's a link to science, because if you look at quantum theory, entanglement and all those weird things and Einstein, you've got a sort of fantasy and then like a bit of magic there in the idea, especially when you look at quantum in terms of taking it to its ultimate conclusion, which is lots of universes. Suddenly you're in a sort of fantasy land that's got a basis in interesting ideas. So that's how I would put J.K. Rowling, to some extent. Well, there's a tiny bit of killing there, but also with Pratchett. Do you accept that?
There's a whole parallel accompanying series called The Science of Discworld. Jack Cohen and his co-author describe the things that Terry describes through the round world lens. So things like telephony or teleportation, physics equivalent of this is what the technology is from the round world and this is how it translates across to the disc. In this one, because it's time travel, and there's a lot of parallels to both the time machine and Wells. There's also Back to the Futures in there, there's Terminator, there's every cliched time travel piece you can get in there, plus a bit of science about the fact that quantum exists and because of quantum thingamies is what Mustram Rikoli refers to, quantum thingamies, and the uncertainty principle and the many universes principle. And when we were doing the annotation for the uncertainty principle, we said it's almost certainly a reference to the uncertainty principle, which I think slipped through to the keeper. So there's quite a bit of round world science embedded in that Discworld way. But the magic in Discworld is mundane. And yet Arthur C. Clarke talked about advanced technology being akin to magic. So there's a really interesting interface between science, technology, and magic. You know, I remember talking to my grandfather and showing him a Google Earth on a phone and the blue dot and zooming in and went all the way into where we were. And he looked at me and said, well, that's amazing. And he said, what is that? What do you call that? I said, I call that a phone, Grandad. And he told me to F off. But if I think about my grandfather, he was born in 1912. So you think about from 1912 to now, what he would have seen in terms of technology and what we would take as absolutely mundane right now would be fantastical. And the Discworld is a bit like that.
Was it a convenient device for you to set your stories there? Because it's such a wacky idea, you could be as weird as you pleased in this world.
Well, no, actually, but the other way around. I said, let's choose a ridiculous planet, but let's put the people on it in what might loosely be called a classic fantasy universe, you know, the one with the trolls and the dwarves and the heroes and the dragons. But then let's treat them as if they are real by our 20th century standards. So the characters are real and as real as I can make them, and the problems they have to face by and large are real problems that we would understand. Mm. There is magic, but it's not often used. Effectively, I suppose the culture of Discworld is partly what Middle Earth would be after its first industrial revolution, if you can possibly imagine that. And in fact, actually just saying that sentence, I can't quite get my head around the idea.
Yeah.
But it is, for want of a better word, the classic fantasy universe brought a little closer up to date, nearly to the verge of a real industrial revolution.
The couple of questions that were lobbed in, I don't know that you would necessarily agree with this question, but why do you think Terry's books were heavily criticised upon release, but they are so loved now?
I don't know that they were criticised. I think the early novels, some of them struggled to get critical acclaim. I wouldn't say they were criticised. Because, as I said, it was a phenomenon. The advent of a new Pratchett book was, from the mid-80s on, a thing that people wanted to attend, and then you used to have queues around the block, and it very well received. But they didn't get critical acclaim. And that notion of literature, it was quite subversive. The early Corgi editions of the Discworld books, they used to have the quotes from the bad reviews in the books.
Right. Yeah, like, that was a good idea.
Which doesn't even write in paragraph, which he put in very tongue-in-cheek because he thought the paragraphs broke up narrative. He wanted people to continue to read and not have to kind of, oh, I'm at the end of this piece and I'll start the next one. And then the notion of being accused of literature, as he collected his own docs, he used to get kind of embarrassed because they were usually doctors of literature, D-lits, that he'd get. And he'd be like, oh, you know, I've never been recognised for contributing to literature. Which is why this one, when Penguin said, we're going to do a modern classic, and it's a Pratchett modern classic, we know, those of us who were in the Discworld honeybee circle, he would have found this hilarious. This notion that he'd never be out of print, he's there beside Tolstoy, he's there beside all of these literary classics in print forever, but he would have been tickled pink, right? Because it is posthumous recognition of the impact he had. It's recognition that he was a literary giant. The works are very, very clever. If you take the Tiffany Aching series, which is the spin-off from the Witch series, okay, he's got a series that's a spin-off from the books. And there's a character that appears in third Discworld novel, Equal Rights, which is a phenomenally good book in its own right. And there's a gap of, like, I think it was 28 years between a character who appeared in that book reappearing, right?
No.
And when she reappears, it makes perfect sense from a narrative perspective. I remember saying to him, what were you doing? Like, boy, did you have a plan? Did you have some sort of notion that this was, I'll put her over there and then I'll pick her off a shelf like 28 odd years later? I went, no, it just seemed the right thing. So incredibly inventive. The map that's in Night Watch, which is drawn by Stephen Briggs, and Stephen and Terry collaborated on a lot of the kind of what Terry used to call the canonical knowledge of Discworld. The things that are in the books, and Stephen Briggs wrote a lot of the books about the books. His drawing of Ankh-Morpork Pork in the book, in the front matter, and it's a bigger one in the hardback, is where the streets are in seven or eight iterations as Terry describes things. Now, Terry never sat down to draw Ankh-Morpork Pork, so he knew spatially where things were. But when Stephen took what was in the books and turned it into the map, things were actually in the right places. So when someone went right on Sator Square, they ended up in the right place. And the relationship between the river, the unseen university, he knew where they were in his mind, and he knew it almost intuitively, but it was topographically correct.
Another short question. How relevant is the writing of Terry Pratchett to today's unfolding political events here and overseas?
You got to laugh, haven't you?
Sometimes I don't.
That's the enemy answer to that one.
Was he political at all?
He didn't like tax very much. He once marched. I think Gordon Brown had brought in the 50 pence tax rate in the UK for creatives. And Terry took out. He could be quite an activist. He took to the streets and he was very much against this notion of being taxed at 50 pence in the pound. And he said, I'm only going to publish every other page.
Here's one. Will you ever write a novel? And what will the first line be?
So, yes, possibly. There are so many trite answers I could give to this one.
I'll give you a nudge. What is the end of days?
Oh, okay.
You can refuse to answer.
No, I could talk about the hypothetical existence of a manuscript, which may or may not be the thing that I think Terry would have written next. And the beginning of that is actually lifted straight out of the beginning of The Curler of Magic, which talks about the turtle living through space. So end of days, there's a photograph that popped earlier on. It's Terry and I on the couch shortly before he passed away. And I went to see him in Wiltshire. We were just catching up. But in that conversation, his dementia was quite advanced. He wanted to write more. He realized he was running out of time. And he was talking about notions that he had for future books. And one of them was about the Discworld itself, because the Discworld sits on top of the elephants, which sits on top of the turtle and goes through space. But the notion that the turtle was ill, was ailing, was one of the things that he wanted to put in place. And that kind of gave me a spark of a notion of an idea. And that might be what End of Days is possibly about.
I think I've not entirely done myself a service with using the image, because people get carried away with this wacky, zany picture. And most of the, in fact, all of the Discworld novels, more or less, deal with the top, the flat bit. And people are no more conscious on a daily basis that there is a turtle underneath them somewhere than we are that we're basically sitting on a big ball of molten iron.
It's interesting. Iris Murdoch, when she was herself suffering from Alzheimer's and towards the end, she wrote her last book and a computer person put the extent of vocabulary from her previous books compared to the last one and said there was a substantial reduction in scope. Did you notice that going on with his writing?
What I noticed was from around Snuffer Raising Steam, Terry was a touch typer. When he wrote books earlier on, he touch typed and he was very efficient and a producer of novels because he was a journalist originally. So he's an old school kind of typewriter guy. And he began to realize the impact of the atrophy. He lost his ability to touch type. He's making more and more errors. So then he switched over to Dragon Dictate software to actually be able to talk to the computer, to be able to just dictate how the novels would work. When you write through your hands, you write in a slightly different way to as you tell a story orally and verbally. So I found there's a change in the books when he was more exclusively using the dictation software to the earlier books. They are more discursive. There's more conversations in the book. There's less descriptive passage because it's kind of...
Lots of conversation in Nightwatch.
Yeah. Now, Nightwatch was a weird one because he used both. So he was doing both things. He wanted to use the dictation software at the time because it helped him get it out quicker. But I do find that stylistically, as you go through, they just read different. They read to me as if I can hear him talking more so than him reading him writing, if that makes sense.
This is The Science Show on Terry Pratchett. And here's the man himself, another thought.
It'd be true to say that if you make a great deal of money writing a great deal of books for a great many readers and appear to smile a lot and don't much give a damn about things, it's amazing how many enemies you can make just by waking up in the morning. To be honest, that never really worries me. I was trained as a journalist, and as a journalist, the important thing is that your words reach as many people as possible. And if they don't do that, in a sense, you've failed.
What sort of journalist was he in the beginning?
He became a journalist and he saw his first body 6 hours later. I think that was the famous quote, in the local press. Then he got a job as a press agent for the nuclear power generation people, which he said was he'd write a book about it if people would believe it.
But that's not the sort of preparation you would expect to have for that torrent of words that he was able to control for such a long time.
Yeah. In Colour of Magic and Life Fantastic and the early books, he was writing those at nighttime, but he started really early. So, I mean, his earliest forays into literature And even his first paycheck as a writer was when he was in school. He used to write short stories, and the Hades Project was a short story that he wrote that he sold and was published in a newspaper. And then more recently, people have found that while he was working for the paper, he was also writing short stories and getting them published in the paper, but he did them under a pseudonym. And so they've gathered them up into a new volume of his published works, which were not published as Terry Pratchett. He was always an author. I think he got more and more sophisticated as time went on. He used to complain whenever he had to do anything with the university, and he complained, you know, I could be writing books. That was his job. And if he wasn't doing his job on a daily basis, he kind of felt like he wasn't providing and he wasn't doing what was expected of him.
Trinity College Dublin is a wonderful place, and I used to stay at building number 5, I think it was, above the rugby pitch.
That's where he lost his ring.
Library, the length, and the statues, it's just magical in so many ways. But it has a tremendous tradition. Okay, you've got some people like Oscar Wilde misbehaving in all sorts of ways. You know, we may be in the gutter, but we're looking up at the stars. You know, that was his excuse, wasn't it, to some extent? But when you suggested you wanted to give Terry Pratchett an honorary doctorate, surely someone whinged.
No. The doctorate went through reasonably easily. Terry was a phenomenally successful author at that stage, and a lot of his books took place in the university. So there was a kind of a tenuous link to making it. And I wanted to meet him, right? Which is one of them, because I was a fan. I thought this is a great excuse to actually get to meet the person you want to meet. You might notice a trend in the honorary doctors of the University of Australia. But when Terry got the letter, because the way it worked in Trinity was nominations went into a nominations committee, and then you never knew who was going to get up and who wouldn't. And the Chancellor would sometimes tell me I'm being far too populist. You're being far too populist, David, I'll be told. But Terry got through on merit, right? And then the letter went to his house, or actually went to his agent, to Colin Smythe, and Terry said, no, I don't want it. I've got 5, I don't want even. But Colin Smythe was a graduate of Trinity College, and he was an on-doc of Trinity College himself as a publisher from Anglo-Irish literature. And Rob Wilkins, who was Terry's personal assistant, had worked for U2 in Dublin and loved coming to Ireland. So he was pressured into saying yes. And he arrived over into the university. And again, it was like when I first met him, he was sitting on the edge of a couch. He just didn't want to be there because he wanted to be writing. Right? But then he warmed up, because on the same day that he got his on-doc, we had Jocelyn Bell, the astrophysicist, and David Attenborough. So you had Terry Pratchett and David Attenborough and Jocelyn Bell, like just amazing people. And I remember going to a dinner that night. Terry was great. He was on fire. Which was better than the very first conversation I had with him, which I'll come back to in a second. But in the course of the dinner, I mean, it was dinner with Terry Pratchett and David Attenborough. And I spent most of the night ignoring David Attenborough, which is not good. I made up for it afterwards, but it wasn't good. When I met him, as far as I was concerned, he was the photograph on the inside cover of a book and didn't know what he was like. And, you know, some people are nice and some people are not nice. And he was looking quite like he didn't want to talk. And I said, oh, what are you working on now? And he said, oh, I'm working on this. I said, and when is that going to come out? This is a year after he'd been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So I wasn't quite sure where we were on the whole Alzheimer's journey. So I was being very tentative in my exploration. Plus I was starstruck. And he goes, oh, it's coming out. He goes, oh, what year is this? And I thought, oh my God, you poor man. That's so bad. And he went, I'm only taking the piss.
One thing about Jocelyn Bell where she wasn't taking the piss was when she was interviewed. Jocelyn Bell was in her anorak checking the signals coming from outer space to measure something else. And there was a regular beat, beat, beat. And these, of course, was the advent of the pulsars. And this was sensational news when it was confirmed. And when a couple of the tabloid papers came along to interview her, the first thing they wanted to know was her vital statistics. True, she gave them. And, of course, her two colleagues, senior men, got the Nobel Prize and she didn't. And when I asked her how she felt about that, she said, I've been dining out about that for years since. It's the first thing that people want to know about. That David Attenborough, you know how old he is at the moment?
I reckon David's 98?
99.
Yeah.
Next birthday, the 8th of May, he'll be 100.
Yep.
Please let him be 101 or 2 or 3 or 4.
Yep, indeed.
Here's productivity for you. But then when it comes to the embuggerance, how did you feel about his description of it? You know, saying it's more or less a bloody nuisance, but beyond that?
He was, at that stage, very, very keen in cures and interventions and therapies and what you might want to be able to do to stave it off, which is completely understandable. And he became a frequent visitor to the uni, and we had some very good neuroscientists, and we had some very good technology people, where he would engage with them and just kind of stimulate them as a kind of a case study, right? You know, what can you do for me, which would do for other people? But then he threw himself into the BBC documentary series. So he did Living with Alzheimer's, and then he did the one where he went to Dignitas with Smedley, because he was interested in assisted dying and became a very, very strong advocate for assisted dying. He also wanted to get as many books out of his mind and onto the page as he possibly could, which is why he got more annoyed when people asked him to do things, took him away from writing. So he became an activist. The political angle was about the fact that assisted suicide or assisted dying was illegal in the UK. And he was incredibly worried that if Lynn, his wife, took him to the airport to take him to Switzerland, that she could be arrested for assisting. So he wanted to have that changed. There's a great Spike Milligan quote about, you know, I don't mind dying, I don't want to be there when it happens. Terry's version of that was, I don't mind dying, but I'd like to be there when it happens. Yeah? It weighed on his mind, and for 6 years, it wasn't very noticeable. He was on Aricept, he was taking care of, to the best of his ability, of the condition. But then when the decline happened, it happened very steeply.
There were other things, but you don't notice them at the time. There's always an excuse. It's a bad day, or the windscreen was fogged, and all those other things. I found driving getting a little more difficult. I now know that was because I was having to use more thought to do things. This was happening automatically. I didn't know. Yeah. One of the things with PCA is things that once upon a time you would not even know you were doing, like turning a doorknob, now becomes something that you have to determine to do. So for me, you'll see me go to the doorknob and carefully, that's a doorknob. We can deal with a doorknob, and away you go. And if you put me in a room with like my hotel room, it's got ornamental glass in some places and as a wall. That's poison to me. I'll walk into the glass.
You walk into the glass.
Of course, he could come here to accept his doctorate from this university. But how did the scholarship come to be?
Well, given that he was a man of imagination, because he knew his time was limited, he wrote letters and he put the letters in the safe. And he told Rob, when I pass away, open the safe and there will be some letters for you to read. And in the letter to Rob, there was a Dear Rob part, there was a I much prefer David to you part, there was the part about the creation of the Order of the Honeybee, which is this thing, but there was one line that said, I rather fancy a scholarship, talk to David and make it happen. So he left an instruction from beyond the grave for us to put that in place. And so I went up to the UK. We sat down with his lawyer. We went through the letter. We said, this is how it'll work. And the Discworld Foundation gave us what was at the time the biggest gift to the arts and humanities in terms of scholarship in Australia. It was fantastic. And it's perpetual, it's there.
And what's it going to fund?
It funds a master's by research student. In fact, now we've got enough in the corpus for it to be a PhD student. It funds a PhD student to produce work of any discipline, any domain, any genre, which is in some way linked back to the works of the Discworld. It could link science and the Discworld, can link literature and the Discworld. And they spend half their time here and half their time in Trinity College in Dublin. And it covers everything.
Has it started yet?
Yeah. We kicked it off, say, 2016, from memory. And the next applications are open in 2027.
And what about your own plans? They asked me that when I turned 80. And Robin, what are your plans? The one thing I found extraordinary about both Hobart and this town is that they're clearly scientific towns. There's no doubt about it at all. And if you compare, say, Sydney's smug in many ways, and they just absolutely assume that they've got all the goods, the treasures, the sites, and so on. But they've only got one scientific Nobel Prize winner.
Oh.
And his name is Sir John Cornforth.
A chemist.
He's a chemist, yes. And what I set up maybe about a year and a half ago was the top 100 Australian scientists. You could be from overseas, it didn't really matter, but as long as you did most of the work here and had some aspect of your personality, your activity that made a difference. And when it comes to Sir John Cornforth, why should you know about him apart from the work was done on the shape of molecules and how they act, macromolecules, you know, proteins becoming enzymes and therefore predicting which proteins or molecules would evolve next. And this man, apart from anything else, couldn't hear a word. He was stone deaf. Imagine studying chemistry to that level through high school, through Sydney University, if you can't hear. Fortunately, later in life, he met Rita, whom he married, and she was not only wise about chemistry, but she could also interpret what he was trying to say in language like that. Now, when you look at this town, the list of extraordinary scientists is almost endless. I'm rather fond of Mark Oliphant because he was a friend, and I was very annoyed when Oppenheimer, the film, came out, and he was left out because he was an essential part of that. Now, when you're thinking of the next move, you can't leave this town with all its wonderful scientists.
No. I've managed to get somebody from Sydney to leave Sydney and come and live with me over here, which is great. But that Nobel Prize to describe macromolecules and the way they interact with small molecules, that underpinned my PhD and my path to becoming a postdoc and my lectureship and my journey to Trinity College. And you could trace a path from that Nobel Prize all the way to me sitting here tonight. So the annotated version of Nightwatch may actually owe something to the sole Nobel Prize winner from Sydney.
The connections, it's amazing, isn't it? Yesterday I had another experience. I went to the Marriott Hotel. Ah, some people are nodding. Which used to be, of course, the old GPO. Still is, to some extent. Half of the building is preserved as that great one, and the other half is the new stuff. And it is all geared to illustrate the ancientness and the activities and using art. But it's celebrating Sir Charles Todd. How many people know about Sir Charles Todd in this room?
How many people are related to Sir Charles Todd in this room?
Another great scientist transformed Australian life by connecting via the telegraph from here to Darwin, and then connecting to the world. The people from this town who've done such incredible work, if only it were known. And that's the kind of effort we're making, trying to get the public to recognize history. And you can do that through writing fantasy. You do that through writing all sorts of stories, but also by looking at the straightforward history and philosophy of science. What do you think about the philosophy of science and the history of it?
I think it's important. Well, you know, sometimes things pass people by and they don't realise what's happening. And I think certain times when you have time for reflection, you get to appreciate what you've missed or maybe understand what you've missed. And in the context of what we were asked to do by Penguin, which was to take a book that people really liked and in some way make it more accessible to people. Because it's a bit weird to pick a book which is like number 29 in a series of 41 books where there's a story which is fantastical, but it's a whodunit murder mystery pursuit piece. And then argue the literary merits of it. So we were doing kind of the philosophy of literature in that regard. But in it, we'd be also managed to work in some hard science. We put in a lot about quantum thingamies. We talked a lot about certainty and Heisenberg. But we also, from a diagnosis of missed things, which if you think about the philosophy of science in the way in which people dissect the way things that have happened unfolded. When I read Nightwatch, I read Nightwatch as a Discworld novel. And you kind of go, okay, this is what happens and what happens next. And you get to the end. When I read it as a professor of chemistry, I went for a laugh. The opening part of the annotation was a heggler, someone who sells posh hegs, right? And then Daryl, because Daryl's a professor of English, went, actually, there's way more to this. And he went on this whole piece, Anglo-Irish English, and the way in which a Protestant would pronounce Hegler or the letter, or a Catholic would. And that was just one word out of a full book. And the appreciation of content and rationale and why things are the way they are and why people have constructed them the way they are, I think it's incredibly important. But it's okay also to skim through on the first piece, as long as you kind of come back to the deeper understanding afterwards.
Looking at the nation and its natural history, and it's so brilliant and it's so much better than anyone thought, because when I was growing up in London, Australia was a joke, and it was created in many ways by one of the dear comedians, you know, writing about Basil McKenzie and siphoning your python and chunders and various things like that. And Australia was at the bottom of the world. It was the afterthought where all the freak show was going on, just like if you remember the bar scene in Star Wars with all those monsters. Now you realize that, in fact, evolution of so much was here affecting the rest of the world. Birdsong, mammals. Mammals came from Australia, not just the ancient ones. And so the other aspect of it is the sheer brilliance of so many of the scientists and the academics and so on. But when it comes to the support for it, I'm asking to be slightly political now you're stepping down, 1.6% of GDP is given to science, scientific research, which is, I think, not even half of some of the leading countries.
Nowhere near the leading. If you look at Korea, they're putting in, South Korea's putting in 4.6.
That's right, like Israel used to be. Yeah.
And so we, as a nation, this is a real diversion, but as a nation, we chronically underfund creativity and undervalue creativity. And that's both on the arts, the humanities and social sciences side of the house and in the sciences. Right? So it's not just about science. Like, research in its broadest sense is underfunded and underappreciated. When you think about what Australia has given the world, the very fact that you can go home and stream Netflix is because of an Australian invention. And it's because of what we did in radar, which gave rise to Wi-Fi, which gave rise to the fact that you've got your password with an exclamation mark at the end of it, and you can use it to access. You can watch Good Omens, right, on streaming. And yet, why would you want to become an importer of great ideas? That was once proposed by a prime minister. Why are we doing research? Why don't we just buy it from somewhere else? And if I was going to get on a Pratchettine kind of high horse on this one, I would go with William Rowan Hamilton. Has anyone heard of William Rowan Hamilton? Irish mathematician. He could count to 10. And he worked on non-Newtonian mechanics, and he worked on a thing called quaternions. And his work on quaternions, he was walking to work and he had an epiphany. And when he had this notion of how to solve this really complicated mathematical equation, the ballpoint pen hadn't been invented. So he took a penknife out and he scratched the formula into the wall of a bridge. Right? It's called Broom Bridge. It's on the way to Dunsink Observatory, which is where he worked. And he was made professor at 16 in Trinity. Super genius. And this was 1845 when he solved the problem of quaternions. And you know when it had application? When we landed on the moon. It was the mathematical equations which allow us to calculate the three-dimensional geometry to land on the moon. And it's also how computer graphics work. So it underpins all of the maths of 3D rendering. Now, if he'd written a grant application in 1845 and said, I would like some money to study pure mathematics because in 124 years, someone will land on the moon. And then 30 years later, Buzz and Woody will win the first animated Academy Award. I don't think he would have got funded. Yeah? However, what people want now is someone to produce Buzz and Woody. Without that kind of capability and capacity and support, we will never get innovation. And do you know what Terry's pet hate was? Tinfoil. Hated tinfoil. And the reason he hated tinfoil was because we just scrunch it up and throw it away. And he thought about how much energy goes into the production of aluminium, a metal, from a rock, so that we can wrap our Kit Kats in it and just throw it away. And when the Washington Monument was built in the States, the top was aluminium because it was such a precious metal.
And here we are discarding it, right? And the need to invest in research has never been greater. And we're never going to have a green economy if we don't put money into science and social work and policy, because we need people to actually to change behaviours as well as having bright ideas. So, yeah, you got me on a high horse. It's not political. It's just it's common sense. Mm. Mm.
And it links quite neatly to Terry Pratchett, because science is an activity looking to the future, because you do not do the breakthrough, doing, and it all works and you apply it next week. No. You've got to do tests, you've got to have the legal look at it, you've got to have the tests to make sure that it's on the right track, the publishing, the other people involved. You're talking about 5 years, even more. And COVID vaccines were an example of the exception, where it really had to be done quickly, and they could do it quickly.
You spend enough money, you can do anything at all.
Dolly Parton gave $1 million. You know, she's a hero. But if you're dealing with something of the future like science and scientific research and education to build up new scientists, you know, from school, because it's going downhill at the moment, you've got an election in 3 years. It's a blink. So there's something one has to do. And via literature, like Terry Pratchett's literature, which is talking about the nature of the future and experimenting and being somewhat satirical about it. You know, you're nodding. Yeah. Do you agree?
Well, so if we go right back to Sorcery, the first one that I read when I was 14. When I was 14 or 15, I knew I wanted to be a scientist. And in Pratchett's books, there are scientist-like people. They've got the wizards doing what they do. And then, in fact, we could talk about his relationship with Australia. If you think about The Last Continent as a book, is set in the Discworld equivalent of its 4X, which is the lost continent. But and Rince, when the wizard ends up down here because of a miscalculation in transportation. And every morning he wakes up and he has to beat the ground because of the spiders and budgerigars wake him up. You know, I came to Australia. I would frequently beat the ground because of the spiders and the budgies would wake me up. But the guilds are a big thing. And so the guild of seamstresses, the guild of thieves, and there's a guild of alchemists. Right? And they have no roof on the building because it frequently blows off. Because I was a chemist. So I used to find these misadventures in alchemy very amusing because they kind of paralleled my experiences as an organic chemist. And when I wrote my own PhD thesis, I had a quote from Moving Pictures, which is a book about the creation of cinema, which is reliant on alchemy to make the nitrocellulose, which is not a good idea, to make the film stock. And the difference between a good alchemist and a great alchemist was about knowing when to be on the far side of the bench when the explosion was going off. Right? I put that into the book, and I got Terry to sign my PhD thesis when I met him. I just wrote on, very true. And he said to me, oh, tell me about your PhD. My PhD was about the production of anti-malarial compounds, and we made this whole series of compounds that killed malaria. But I had to use a lot of cyanide to make these compounds. It was the starting material was a cyanide compound, and it meant that I had to make a lot of cyanide, and I wasn't very popular in the lab because the more you get exposed to cyanide, the higher tolerance goes. So I was okay doing things on the bench. The guys in the lab would all be kind of staggering around saying, please stop. And I was telling Terry about the fact that with my PhD, I had to wash my hands before I went to the bathroom because I was using these compounds. And then a parcel arrived in my office in Trinity, and it was UK postmark, and I opened it up, and it was a book, and it was called The Poison Principle. And it's by Gail Bell. It's an Australian author who wrote about her grandfather who poisoned his sons. It's a history of poisoning. And I opened it up, and he wrote, and the first page said, to David, wash your hands afterwards.
You mentioned mathematician just now. Can you think of two mathematicians who really have made you laugh and who are good at writing and maybe even music?
No. And we haven't rehearsed this. This reminds me very much of the time I got my honorary doctorate from Unseen University, from Terry Pratchett, in a room very like this with about as many people in it. And he asked me questions and I didn't know the answers. And I'd spent an hour interviewing him and he goes, oh, now it's my turn. Mm-hmm. I went, oh, yeah. And I was thinking, this is interesting. And the questions he asked me, the first question he said to me was, what is the motto of the Unseen University? Right? I was exactly the same. Crickets, not a clue. And I'd read every book. And it's now you see it, now you don't. In Latin. And I thought to myself, bugger that. Why didn't I know that? And after that, he, out of sympathy, in pure sympathy, he still bestowed the doctorate on me. And it's in my office here, because I've got my honorary doctorate signed by Rid Cully, and I got a scarf and I have a badge. And I'm entitled to skip the queue in certain settings. There's a big list of things. It's a doctor of Sweet Fanny Adams, which is really, really important. But at that time, he'd asked me the question. He asked me three questions, and I didn't know the answers to any of them. And I told myself, I thought I was pretty good at this. I thought I knew what was going on in the books. I mean, many, many years later, Penguin are going to ask me to do annotations because I seem to know what's going on in the books. I reread all the books. And it took me a while because there were quite a lot of them at the time. And then the next time I saw him, I said, Terry, those questions you asked me, the answers are not in the books, because they weren't. He went, no, it was a test of your canonical knowledge.
I thought you were going to mention something to do with a certain lecture going on.
Oh, that one, Lynn. That didn't make me laugh.
Really, I think it's so much to do with the quantum question of
but not a very nice person.
Schrödinger?
Yeah. So let's...
The Schrödinger lecture in Dublin.
Schrödinger left Germany of the 30s for any number of reasons and found himself enshrined in the Dublin Institute of Advanced Science, which was created for him by Eamon de Valera, who was the president of Ireland at the time, and a person who understood that it was important to invest in science and research. And Schrödinger wrote the book, What is Life? He did that book.
What is Life was an inspiring for people doing DNA research.
So Watson and Crick were inspired by What is Life, and they wrote This is Life, I think was the book after when they got the structure. I think Jimmy Watson wrote that book. And then Craig Venter read that book and then went on to sequence the human genome. So like they have these massive scientific kind of lineages. But Schrödinger, anyway, of the famous cat in a box, is a dead or quantum, right? I mean, it's dead and alive until you look at it and then it collapses. When Schrödinger came to Dublin, he used to give a lecture in Trinity College, and it was the Schrödinger lecture. And so he espoused that whole theory about quantum states of uncertainty and flux in a lecture in Dublin. And so then Trinity, to capitalize on that, would run the Schrödinger lecture on an annual basis. And Terry was over for a visit, and I was doing a thing with him, which was designed for kind of giggles. And I said to him, oh, the Schrödinger lecture's on tonight, because I was the dean of research at the time, and I was kind of supposed to
go. Baby dean.
Yeah, that's true. I was supposed to go to the Schrödinger lecture to hang out with all the sciencey people, but I was much more interested to hang out with all the literary people and Terry Pratchett at the Terry function. And I said to Terry, oh, you know, the Schrödinger lecture's on tonight. I said, oh, yeah, that's a lecture that you don't know if it's on or not until you open the door. Yeah.
And if you open the door, it's empty, but there's a cat and it's dead. To answer my question about mathematicians who make you laugh, one was a professor of pure mathematics at Oxford. He had two names. One was Charles Dodgson. The other was Lewis Carroll.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote Alice in Wonderland. It was Brig and the Slithy Toads, Gyre and Gimble in the Wabe. And the other one got himself into Harvard to study maths at the age of 15, called Tom Lehrer. They can be satirical.
Yeah.
That's the way of doing it, and putting all those things together. You see, scientists are not isolated in their intellect unless they're forced to be.
I don't think anybody is. If you have the capacity to pop yourself up above your disciplinary niche, you can enjoy all sorts of things. And that goes back to Rat Pack mind, right? I mean, the pack rat mind. Right? Terry, he left with a clutch of A-levels, O-levels actually, he didn't finish his A-levels. So he left school early, was interested in literature. He liked books, he liked words, and he liked information, and he liked knowledge. And he has a whole theory, the L-space theory, which goes right back to the interface between science and literature, which is if words equate to knowledge, knowledge is power, power is energy, right? And energy is equal to mass, and mass distorts things. So a library is infinite in its creation because it's got books in it. It's the L-space theory that the power of words can distort space and time, which is why when hero of our novel, Sam Vimes, is on top of the Unseen University dome in the book and it gets struck by lightning, because of the nature, the Mobius nature of the library itself, that's how the time travel thing happens. It's this kind of connection of all these bits and pieces. So.
That is the end of our conversation. And thank you for coming all this way and being here on the night. Thank you.
I was with the then Vice Chancellor of the University of South Australia, Professor David Lloyd at the Hawke Centre. Terry Pratchett, or Professor Pratchett, A Recollection, is David Lloyd's own book of his hero. Next week, another astounding scientific genius, Emily du Châtelet, creator of the Enlightenment, no less, and responsible for the C in E equals MC squared, a Christmas present from The Science Show. Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.